The good news is I have very few slides, so don't get too panicked if you're a PowerPoint hater. There's an increasing cadre of PowerPoint haters emerging around the world. And hopefully they're not part of Anonymous and they won't be they won't be attacking any of us. Well, I want to begin with a disclosure, which is also something I'm proud of. As I say at the end of every article I ever write about Facebook or Google, at the bottom of it always says that Larry Magid is co-director of ConnectSafely.org, a nonprofit internet safety organization that receives financial support from Facebook, Google, and other technology companies. And I say that as a disclosure because I want people to know that. But I also want you to understand that as somebody who works very closely with those and other companies, and I actually live about a mile from Google and about a mile and a half from Facebook, go back and forth, visit them often, I've gotten to know them. I am not an apologist for either one. I am critical of both. When the New York Times did a story about the Facebook Safety Advisory Board and tried to make the point that we were a mouthpiece for Facebook, they had to point out that, number one, I disclosed it, and number two, I frequently criticized them. So it's not like I'm going to tell you that they're wonderful, but I am going to tell you that I spend a lot of time with executives from both companies, all the way from the CEO to the folks that concentrate every day on safety, privacy, and security. And unlike some things I've heard at this and other conferences, they do put thought into issues of safety, privacy, and security. They often don't get it right, and they have conflicting values and conflicting commercial interests, which may cause them to make decisions that some people in this room might not like. But it's not as if they don't put an enormous amount of thought, resources, and effort into trying to get it right in consistency with their goals as companies. So just to establish that starting off, I want to also establish another credential in terms of my understanding of privacy. This document that you probably can't quite decipher, it is not my doctoral dissertation. It could or couldn't be considered a dossier. Well, it is a dossier. It could or couldn't be considered perhaps a treatise on what a great guy I am. What it is, it's my FBI file. So as you can tell by my gray hair, I've been around the block once or twice, and I was a student at Berkeley, at the University of California, Berkeley, in the late 60s. And any of you who know the history of student activism in the United States, and for that matter, Canada and the rest of the world, know that there was a lot of things going on at that time. And so I was a horrible criminal in that I was vehemently opposed to the war in Vietnam, which, by the way, is now sort of commonly accepted as having been correct. And I also had the audacity to suggest there should be such a thing as racial equality in the United States, which put me in the same league as this other criminal, Martin Luther King. I shouldn't say the same league, put me with the same sentiments. He was in a much bigger league and was arrested far more times than I was. But nevertheless, I was a social activist at Berkeley. And sometime during the 70s, I applied under the Freedom of Information Act for a copy of my FBI file. It's pretty hard to see from this picture. It was taken with a cell phone by my daughter. I had the idea yesterday. This is the first time I've ever even mentioned that I have an FBI file in public. And it's the first time I've even showed a picture of it in public. So I had my daughter take a cell phone picture of it and send it to me night before last. It's about 500 or 600 pages long. If you were to go through it, you'd find it was mostly redacted. You can see already some black ink on the front page, and throughout it there's black ink. And they did such things as followed me around Eugene, Oregon, where I was living for a while, noted that I had gone to the post office, which in itself is kind of a communist institution. Government workers. In the U.S., in Eugene, Oregon, we had this WPA, this Work Progress Administration post office, where they had actually paid people out of federal money to make it pretty. Things that might be considered commonplace in Canada, but in the United States, obviously granted you as some kind of a communist if you went to these public buildings. And then at one point, they had me as an Afro-American leader at Howard University, which is a rather big leap of faith. They listed me at various times as socialists, anarchists, communists, and even liberal, which I think at the time might have been the biggest insult. And after many years of apparently following me around, they finally concluded I was no longer a threat to the security of the United States, and they finally closed my file somewhere around 1975, which, by the way, coincidentally was around the time Nixon had resigned, and I think J. Edgar Hoover had finally died at that point. But J. Edgar Hoover was, in fact, alive and well, and his name, although I don't think he personally spied on me, Many of the memos in this document were sent to him and to his senior lieutenant. So I guess maybe I have the honor of having been on his watch list. Again, along with Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and other well-known subversives, some of whom have holidays named after them. So that's my credentials. When I speak to you about privacy and security and surveillance, I know from where I come or from what I speak. Now, speaking of J. Edgar Hoover, he would be so happy today. Could you imagine what his life would be like if he were around and trying to spy on people today? He would love Facebook, and he would love Google. And one of the reasons he would love Google, of course, would be the ability to find out just about anything that's ever been said about any of us online, good, bad, indifferent. If you Google me, you will find pages and pages and pages and pages of references, some of which are actually accurate. If you scroll down far enough, and you have to go down really far, you'll find some negative things written about me. But because I publish several times a week, there's a bunch of positive stuff way higher than that. Hint, if somebody points something bad on you on the internet, you're not going to be able to get them to take it down, probably, but you can put other stuff up there that might bury it. So think about that. But speaking of how we expose ourselves, Facebook just launched Social Graph. And J. Edgar Hoover would be really, really happy if he had access to Social Graph. So I did a search on my own Social Graph, which in my case, I don't know exactly how big it is. If you think about it, I have about 3,000 friends, and the average Facebook user has 265 friends. So if you multiply 3,000 times 265, it's a heck of a lot of people. I also have about 125,000 subscribers, so it's a pretty big Social Graph. But I just did a search on my friends who are liberal, something that J. Edgar Hoover would have been very interested in. And the two top hits were my wife, who's sitting back in the back of the room. By the way, that's that. My daughter's now 28 years old. My wife's exactly the same age. But my daughter's 28 years old. And as it happens, my business partner at Connect Safely, both of whom admitted to being liberals, which I have to qualify, by the way. You understand that the only thing worse in the United States than being a liberal is being a Canadian. So just to put that into context. But there were hundreds and thousands. I then, after this, and I didn't want to out anybody who wasn't close to me. I got permission from Patty and Ann both to put their pictures in this slide. But after that, I used Facebook Social Graph to say who has liked Occupy Wall Street. And I don't know whether it was hundreds or thousands because I didn't count, but lots and lots of people in my Social Graph had liked Occupy Wall Street. So, Mr. Hoover, if you're around, and I'm sure you are, and I'm sure you're listening, because why stop at death? This would be an amazing tool to find out who subscribes to certain ideologies. I, for one, am very careful about what I do on Facebook. For example, I know this sounds un-American of me. It used to be, but now it's not un-American. It's okay because the president now publicly agrees with me. But I happen to think that it's okay to marry anybody you want. Well, within reason, as long as, you know, they're an adult and you're an adult, things like that. And so when California put up a proposition, Proposition 8, to outlaw same-sex marriage, I was opposed to it. I didn't like that. So I went on to Facebook, and I was just about to like. This is kind of odd. How do you like something you don't like? There should be an unlike button, but there wasn't. So I was just about to like the campaign against Prop 8 until I realized that by liking something, I was making a public statement. And although I am proud to be supportive of same-sex marriages, or, you know, and by the way, those of us who support same-sex marriages typically also support heterosexual marriages too. So just so you understand that none of us are trying to threaten, you know, anybody else's marriages. But even though I support that, I realized that by doing so, I'd be taking a public position on a actual proposition that was on the ballot, and that violates CBS News policy. CBS News has a policy that their employees and consultants are not allowed to take positions on public events, which is why, although my wife spent a month in Ohio campaigning for Obama, I didn't, because I'm not allowed to do things like that. So that had for me an immediate chilling effect. And so even as we speak, I am extremely careful as to what I like on Facebook. So what I want to talk a little bit about is the way in which we approach not just privacy, but all of the evils on the internet. As I mentioned at the beginning, and as I was kindly mentioned in my introduction, I'm co-director of ConnectSafely.org and founder of SafeKids.com. And these two organizations, well, SafeKids.com is a website, but the organization, ConnectSafely, works a lot in the area of internet safety. And in 2004, I don't know if the show actually aired here in Canada, but there was a TV show called To Catch a Predator. Did that air in Canada?
Yeah.
So millions of people were, every Thursday night, turning onto NBC and watching a show about these people that were on the internet trolling children, trying to have sexual relationships with kids that they met online. That, combined with other media exposure, combined with every attorney general in the United States, all we have 50 of them, all states have them, plus we have a attorney general for the country, were fanning the flames of predator, predator, predator. And people were beginning to think there was a predator behind every keyboard. So we actually did some research. What we really did is we looked at the research. I actually did write a dissertation a long time ago, even after my FBI file was compiled, as a kind of a sociologist, educational research, and I knew a little bit and know a little bit about how to read a research report. So I looked at the data, and I found out that the data that this was based on, it was this notion that 1 in 5 children had been approached by an online predator. That was floating around the media. What the data really said is that 1 in 5 children had received an unwanted sexual solicitation. And when you looked at the study, what you found out that most of those were from other children. The vast majority of them were not aggressive. And every single one of them, or I should say absolutely none of them, resulted in child actually being physically harmed. And so when you actually parsed it and did the analysis, you found out that the statistical odds of meeting somebody on the internet for the first time and them sexually harming you, although they existed, it wasn't impossible, it was far, far lower than the probability of being molested by your own relative, by a teacher, by a police officer, by a pediatrician, by your parent. So the real takeaway is if you want to keep children safe, don't let them go home, go to school, or go to the doctor, and certainly don't let them interact with police officers. I mean, obviously absurdities, but it had to be put in context, and there was other things. So we coined the term predator panic. And as long as I was on a roll, I started thinking about other panics. So one of the things that we accomplished as Connect Safely is we were on all sorts of federal task forces and published about a bunch of reports, and we actually got the conversation to change. And so then the field that we're in, the internet safety field, or what I call the safety, privacy, security, military, industrial complex, began to change its tune and focus on a bigger threat, a real threat, a threat that is statistically significant, which is bullying. And so then we created bullying panic. And if you read the literature today, you'll find epidemic of bullying, epidemic of cyberbullying. The internet has caused a huge increase in the rate of bullying. Well, that's what the media says. What the researchers say, what you find is that bullying is actually on the decline. And although cyberbullying has gone up because it went from zero in 1990 to something in the 2000s, it is still far below the declining rate of bullying in general. And I could give you numbers, and they're all over and they're not exact, but certainly it's not an epidemic, it's a serious problem. And also, even if you look at the numbers at 20% or 17% or 6%, depending on what study you find, bullying is not a one-size-fits-all thing. Some bullying is extremely serious and causes people to go into deep depression and do things that are awful. A lot of bullying is simply fluffed off, and people go on and deal with it. And so, we panic. We treat it as if there's this one big, giant bullying. And then came sexting panic. And so we got privacy panic, we got sexting panic, we got bullying panic, we had predator panic. All of these panics, all they really accomplish is to get people to be afraid, is to get people to be afraid of what's new, of what they think they understand but don't understand, and often, and hence the title of my talk, often focusing on the wrong risks. So in the internet safety field, we were so worried about predators, we weren't paying attention to bullying. Now we're so worrying about bullying, we're not paying attention to what people are saying that's going to hurt their own reputation. We're so worried about sexting that we're not worried about sextortion, which is the situation where some people, my computer has died and I have no notes. There we go. And we tend to focus on risks that are, well, potentially real, are also exaggerated. So let's talk about some of the privacy issues and privacy security issues. As I mentioned, the safety, security, privacy, military, industrial complex, that's a line borrowed from Dwight D. Eisenhower, who at the end of his term as president talked about the military-industrial complex. And I think that there is something that we need to think about. There are companies, some of them are right out here. I'm sure they're all very good companies and all have good intentions that are making money on privacy, safety, and security. There are people, myself included, and probably most people in this room, that are making money, that are employed in the field of privacy, safety, and security. And so we have to be careful about goal displacement. We have to be careful that we understand that while we have very important work to do, we don't enhance our position by exaggerating the risk and by creating fear. We enhance our position by being honest with people, by being accurate, and by constantly rethinking and reanalyzing what are the risks, what are the concerns. Are there any risks that we can check off? Can we ever say, oh, we can take credit for having caused that to go away as new ones emerge? And by the way, there's never going to be a shortage of new ones, because as long as there are smart people in Silicon Valley and other parts of the world, there will always be new technologies and new things for us to scare the shit out of people over. So don't worry. You've got job security. So privacy is important. And privacy, you know, the right to privacy is very important. But also people have the right not to be scared to death. I have concluded from my observations in this field, I've been online now since 1979. I guess that gives me a pretty early start on things. Wrote my first book about online stuff in, I think, 82, that the biggest risk to privacy is you and me. It's what we post about ourselves. It's what we say about ourselves. You can worry about tracking. You can worry about hackers. You can worry about big data. You can worry about big government. You can worry about Google and Facebook, and you should. But the thing you need to worry most about is what you post on the internet. Now, I know that's obvious to people in this room. You walk outside, there's this wonderful comic book that the Privacy Commissioner of Canada has produced for Canadian teens, which pretty much says this. It pretty much lays that out. But when you ask people about privacy, so often they will look to some external threat, to something that's completely out of their control anyway, that somehow is going to harm them, and they're failing to think about what is under their control. I'm reminded, and by the way, what I'm about to tell you is the lead of my San Jose Mercury News column for Monday, which I think is online now. It should be going online this morning, which is, as I flew here, right? Many of us flew here. I bet you there are a lot of people who drive to the airport, weaving in and out of traffic because they're late for the train, for the plane, risking their lives, maybe not even wearing their seatbelt, and then they're worried about the plane crashing. Well, two problems with that scenario. Number one, although planes do on rare occasion crash, they rarely do, and cars crash a lot more often. So statistically, even if you're driving safely, you're more likely to be harmed or killed in a car crash than an airplane crash. And two, and most important, you had something to do, you had some control over your drive to the airport, assuming you were driving your own car. Once you got on that plane, you were just a passenger. You pretty much were under the influence or under the control of the airline and the air traffic control and the other planes that are flying around the sky. And that's sort of how we often approach our privacy, safety, and security. We somehow worry about and wonder and protect, expect Big Brother or Little Brother or some entity to take care of us or to harm us, and fail to think about how we can drive safely, how we can put on our seatbelts, how we can take some basic precautions. And as you know, you can drive safely, you can wear a seatbelt, you can be sober, but you can still be hit by a drunk driver. So there's nothing that will protect you 100% of the time. Never have I ever claimed that if you follow every piece of advice I ever give you, that you are 100% safe. That's why, by the way, we celebrate every year, at least in some countries, a holiday called Safer Internet Day, and it's called Safer Internet Day, and not Safe Internet Day, because we don't know yet how to create a safe internet. We only know how to create a safer internet. So I've been thinking about this whole tracking stuff, because I know that's on the minds of a lot of people, a lot of regulators. And I remember a day, and I can't remember exactly when it was, but I know it was before 9/11. 9/11 was sort of a turning point in a lot of things. I think I know it was because of 9/11, because I got on a plane that day, and I don't remember being terribly annoyed about the process of getting on it. And for some reason, I was supposed to fly from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, but I made a last-minute decision to go to Los Angeles. I'm not sure why anymore. I can't remember. But I decided I'm going to get in a plane to L.A., I think to visit my mom, probably. I decided to get in a plane to L.A., and I realized I hadn't called Patty, my wife, who's actually sitting in the back room, to tell her that I was going to L.A. I figured I'd tell her when I landed. I actually hadn't told anybody, hadn't told work. Nobody knew I was in L.A. And I'm sitting at Jerry's Restaurant. I remember it very vividly in San Fernando Valley. Anybody's ever been to Jerry's Restaurant? You're supposed to see movie stars there, but I never see any. But I'm sitting, talk about privacy. And if I did, of course, I would respect their privacy. But I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, oh, this is kind of weird. Nobody knows where I am. And then I said, wait a minute. American Airlines knows where I am because they flew me here. Hertz knows where I am because I rented a car from them. American Express knows where I am because I charged my Hertz rental car and my airline ticket to my American Express. Verizon knows where I am because I pinged one of their cell towers. I hadn't even made a phone call, but I pinged one of their cell towers. And Visa or MasterCard knew where I was because that's how I paid for my meal. And even back then, I could go back to the 80s and probably 70s or 60s, I was being tracked. There was a profile of my whereabouts by big companies that I had no control over, that actually, in some cases, had a vested interest in not only needing to know where I was. I mean, I think it was pretty legitimate for Hertz to ask for ID before they let me borrow a $25,000 car. But the bottom line is that they also use that information and still use that information to market, to rent, to sell. And even back then, it was an issue. Has it changed? Well, sure, it's changed. I mean, tracking is it's much more common. It happens more often. It happens to more people. And of course, it happens in ways that we have even less control over. But the basic concept isn't new. Supermarket cards. My biggest fear when I go to Safeway, I don't know if you have Safeways down here, but you have big supermarkets. You know, they have those cards where you can, they're called cards. They're supposed to give you a discount, but what they really do is if you don't use them, you pay too much. And if you do use them, you pay the right price or the normal price or the market price for whatever it is you buy. So I consider them anti-privacy cards, right? Because their main purpose is to gather information about who you are, what you buy, when you bought it, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, my biggest fear has always been, and this is a fear that only an American would have because we actually don't have guaranteed health insurance in our country. My fear is that Safeway and Blue Shield, my insurance company, are going to collaborate one day and Blue Shield is going to find out how much ice cream I buy and either cancel my policy or raise my rates. And of course, I'm hoping by 2014 they will have already raised the rates because they'll no longer be able to cancel my policy because thanks to you communist Canadians and the Brits and the rest of the world, we now have a miniaturized version of socialized medicine that really isn't, but well, thank you. We have a long way to go, trust me. We now have the right to pay too much for our insurance like we used to, but now they have to sell us insurance at too high a price. Before they could turn you down at too high a price. But the bottom line is that you know, I worried about that. But the reality is, as far as I can tell, that information has never reached my insurance company. How do I know that? Because a hell of a lot of other information has reached my insurance company. I don't know how it works in Canada, but every time I go to the doctor, for whatever reason, my insurance company knows about it. They have all of the details. We have laws protecting my privacy against my wife, against my kids. In other words, my wife can't call up my doctor and find out the diagnosis when I went in to see her, but my insurance company automatically gets that information. They know they know all the drugs that I've purchased, they know all the prescriptions, all the diagnosis I've had, they know all the checkups I've had, and they use it against me. This is a real harm. This is not some theoretical, gee, they might do something like Safeway and the ice cream. This is real. This is why my rates are a little bit higher now than they used to be, because I made the mistake of accepting a job and taking a insurance policy from a company, and then while that happened, I don't know what I did, I hurt myself or something, and when I came back, it was at a higher rate, because they knew all this. So there are real examples of harm, at least in my country, I don't know how it works here, based on what certain companies know about you. And again, that's not new, that goes way back. So talk about tracking. This kind of bad tracking and good tracking. When I log on to Expedia to make my travel arrangements, I kind of like the fact that there's a cookie on my machine that allows me to not have to enter my username and password. That's not really tracking, it's a cookie whose purpose is benevolently put there to make my life easier. When I go on to Netflix, they recommend shows that they think I might want to watch, and sometimes they actually get it right, and I appreciate that. I really like it. I like the fact that with all those thousands of programs that I could watch on Netflix, I can't find all of them. There is a recommended list of ones that some algorithm thinks that I might like. When I go on to Amazon, very similar. They're recommending books and products. And believe it or not, I have actually purchased books and products based on those recommendations that I hadn't thought of, but they reminded me it was in their interest because they get to sell a product, but it was in my interest because I was exposed to something that I actually wanted to. I like that. And there are examples that I don't like. I can admit this because I'm in Canada. keep, don't tell anybody. But about 2 weeks ago, my wife and I and my son went to Cuba. Now, the reason is my son was, my son, WillMaggot.com, Will Maggot Trio, I'm plugging him, right? No opportunity to miss advertising, Google would be proud of me. My son was performing at the Havana Jazz Festival. And so it was a cultural event, which arguably is probably actually legal to go to a cultural event. But nevertheless, the U.S. has these silly laws about traveling to Cuba. But before I went, I did two things. I searched, one, for airfares to Cuba from Mexico, because you can't fly to Cuba from the United States except under rare circumstances. And I also traveled. I also searched for legal travel to Cuba, because I did want to know the procedure whereby I could get a license to do it legally. And wouldn't you know, just the other day, I logged on to some website, and there were some people in the room with me, and big flashing on the screen was travel to Cuba. No coincidence. What are the odds? How many people here have ever had travel to Cuba ads pop up on their screen? Well, if you ever make arrangements to go to Cuba online, you probably will from then on. And that creeped me out. Now, one of the things that kind of silly about it, I'd already been and come back, so I didn't want to go to Cuba anymore. But the second thing was that it was something I had done, which I'm not ashamed of. I actually put some stuff on Facebook about it, but it's not necessarily something that I want the world to know, although it does now. But the bottom line is that I wanted control over that, and it was flashing on my screen. Now, you could argue it was just flashing on my screen, so why should I care? But again, I use a computer in a room with other people occasionally, and so I had no reason to assume that there was any purpose of hiding my screen, and up pops an ad which could have implicated me into doing something that maybe I didn't want to share. That bothers me. On the other hand, with that experience aside, a lot of the tracking ads that I see don't bother me at all. Because if I've got to see ads anyway, I'd rather see an ad for something that I might want versus something that I have no interest in. One of the problems with television is that they can only serve you ads based on the demographic that they think is watching their show. So if I'm watching the CBS Evening News, my own company's broadcast, I'm going to be watching ads for Lipitor and Viagra and other drugs that are actually aimed at people my age, but I don't think I want those and need them, and I'd rather look at hot cars. But I don't get to make that choice, because all they're doing, and if you happen to be a 22-year-old watching CBS Evening News, you're still seeing ads for Viagra and Lipitor. Although you might be interested in the Viagra. Could you imagine Viagra at a 22-year-old? Well, I won't go there. But the bottom line is, it was targeted behavioral advertising. In theory, at least, you could benefit from it, seeing something that is at least marginally interesting, since you're going to have to see ads anyway. The other argument that the industry makes, and I don't dismiss this, is, you know, it costs a lot of money to run Google. It costs a lot of money to run these big, the New York Times, Huffington Post, New York Times actually charges, so they're different, but Huffington Post is another example, which I write for, incidentally. And the way in which they can make more money is to have targeted advertising. And so the argument goes is, if we give up targeted advertising, who's going to pay for the content? And there are actually some proposals out there that we should have a choice, and that information providers should say, okay, targeted advertising, you get free content. If you don't want targeted advertising, you have to pay for content. So that's something that has to be taken seriously. We can't simply write that off. Unless you want to write off all of that great free content you're seeing, unless you want to write off that great search engine you get from Google and Bing and others, you can't completely write off targeted advertising, because it is part and parcel with the services we get. I'm not saying it's 100% justifiable, but I'm saying that it has to be taken seriously, because these companies have to monetize in order to stay in business, and that is one way that they can monetize. Having said that, control and transparency, I think, is an inalienable human right. So, well, I want the right to turn off targeted advertising, although that may give Google the right to not let me use their search engine or charge me to use their search engine. But I'm willing to have that discussion as long as there's transparency and as long as there's choice. There are other issues that we tend to focus on which I think are silly. I'm sure you all heard about the Google Wi-Fi sniffing case. Was that a big deal in Canada? Did you guys fine them for that or put Larry and Sergey in prison? I don't think so. I haven't noticed them with stripes on lately. A lot of issues have been made about that, especially in Europe. Oh my God, Google is going around driving cars around communities, sniffing data from Wi-Fi. Well, aside from the fact it was public Wi-Fi, it truly was an accident. It was not something that they meant to do. And it was a byproduct of something that they were doing that benefits people. They were trying to improve geolocation so that when you go on your Android phone or other device and you use Google Maps to get from point A to B, it happens quicker and it happens more accurately. And as somebody who uses smartphone-based navigation software, I really appreciate it when it actually gets me to the right place, because I've experienced times when it hasn't. I still remember the time when I was trying to get from one part of Boston to another and they tried to get me to go over the Boston Harbor. Not a good way to do it. So there is something to be said for having, again, privacy panic, panicking over the thing which actually, as far as I can tell, and correct me if I'm wrong, never really harmed anybody. Or if it did, it was a very, very small number of people. And so there is this tendency to kind of react to these situations because they make great press. And by the way, I'm a former board member of Consumer Watchdog, which capitalized, or I shouldn't say capitalized, which rabble-roused about that issue for months and still does. And I just thought they were being silly. Another situation is protecting children from marketing. Are you familiar with COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act? It's an American act, it's an American law, but it affects you and everybody else in the world. Because what it says is that in order to provide personal information to a web page, if you're under 13, you have to have verifiable parental consent. And that's hard to do. It's expensive, it's cumbersome. There are companies that do it. There is such a thing as COPPA compliance. Disney goes through great cost to make sure that they're compliant with COPPA because they really, really want under 13s on their sites. But Facebook, at least so far, hasn't gone to that expense. And so therefore, if you want to be on Facebook, you have to be 13. Same with LinkedIn. Twitter doesn't ask about age. So Twitter has found a way not to have to deal with COPPA, but they probably will eventually. COPPA was recently revised. If anything, it was strengthened. It's not going away. But COPPA was written in 1999. And a law that was designed to protect children from evil marketers harassing them on the web and trying to sell them stuff actually wound up protecting them from their own right to express themselves in social networking. And I would argue that a law that keeps children from using social networking is a violation of their free speech. And if you look at the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, hooray, I'm in a country that ratified it. The only country that haven't that I'm aware of are Somalia and the US. We're in great company. Don't you love my country? The UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, I think it's Article 19, I can't remember, I'm not very good with articles, has a clause in there that talks about the right to access any media, and they list a bunch of medias, or any media that may ever emerge. And clearly, the internet is a media. And one could argue that a law that blocks children from accessing media is a violation of their rights. Now, I know I'm an extremist. I know I'm not going to get anywhere with that. I've already tried. The Federal Trade Commission has reenacted COPPA. But I think it's worth thinking about the fact that if our goal is to protect children's privacy, how does that affect our other goal, which is to encourage children's engagement? I think everybody should have some privacy. And in fact, I think COPPA should be renamed PAPA, the People's Online Privacy Protection Act. Of course, then you would think about PAPA and Daddy and big government, but that issue aside, if you're going to protect privacy, protect all of our privacy. But if you're going to protect anyone's privacy, how do you do it in a way that doesn't also interfere with their rights? Perfect example is the right to be forgotten. I fully understand the sentiment behind the right to be forgotten. But as a journalist, if I write something about you, and if it happens to be true, which in most of my stories are, then I don't want you to have the right to erase what I wrote. I don't think that's your right, especially if you're a criminal, but even if you're not a criminal. There's a difference between your right to erase what you posted, which I fully support. You want to go into Facebook and delete anything you've ever posted, fine. But if I go onto Facebook and I say, I think Susan's dress last Tuesday was ugly, I may be rude, I may be annoying, I may be bullying, but I am exercising my constitutional right to free speech. Now, there are extremes. There are cases of libel and slander, and there's what Cole spoke about earlier, where you've got trolls that do it in such a way that becomes absolutely awful. But the bottom line is that we do have a right to express ourselves, and sometimes my right to free speech gets in the way of your right to privacy. And it's not a clear issue as to which right ought to prevail. So we really need to think of the unintended consequences of creating such strong privacy laws that we wind up violating other rights. And that's just one of many examples. What Cole talked about, any law that would require authentication would violate your right to anonymity, if we agree you have a right to anonymity. And certainly there are political activists, legitimate political activists, not trolls, who could give a very compelling argument why they are alive today because of their right to anonymity. And also people who aren't alive because they were outed for what they did. Location. Another interesting phenomenon. It was about 6 years ago that I gave my first talk on location-based services. I remember it well. It was in Washington, D.C. It was the Congressional Internet Caucus. I was standing up full in a room full of congressional aides, and I was telling them something that they didn't know, which it is now possible for your cell phone to disclose your location, and people were shocked. I told them that, at least in the United States, that was a byproduct of our 911 system, because if you called for an ambulance on your cell phone, they needed to know where you are. So the government required cell phone companies to put location awareness technology in their phones, strictly for the use of 911, but didn't prohibit them from using that same technology for other purposes, and the rest is history. And as you know, it is hard to download a smartphone app today that doesn't ask permission to know your location. Sometimes you wonder why in a million years they would ever want to know your location, and if I can't think of any legitimate reason, I usually deny that. But often they do have a good reason. For example, a friend finder service, and there are many of them out there, that will help you find out if your friends are nearby. Or a navigation service, obviously. A service like Glimpse that I use frequently to help my family know where I'm going when I'm traveling. Not only does it tell them where I am, it tells them how fast I'm driving. Which was really interesting when I used it on a bus one day between Washington and New York, and I got hundreds of people. I tweeted my location, and people said, "You realize the bus is going 85 miles an hour? Am I about to get the hook?" Apparently, my gosh. And I'm just getting started. Wow. I'm having so much fun. How much time do I have? Or the hook? All right. So I'm going to have to skip almost in my entire speech. But that's okay, because I had produced a list, which I understand is going to be on the website, and these are the things that I do worry about. I just want to go a couple of them. Social engineering, we just heard a great presentation on it, scares the crap out of me, because really smart people can get hooked by that. In fact, having heard that conversation, I probably would have gotten hooked by the trick that guy did. Talking on the cell phone in public, boy, have I gotten some juicy tidbits living in Silicon Valley, hearing Silicon Valley executives talk about secrets that I got to hear. Weak passwords, shortened links, baby registries, boy, those are dangerous. There's just so many things that we can worry about. And not all of these, but many of these are things that are within our control. So what I would leave you with is that what we really need, in addition to great regulations, thank you regulators, in addition to really good best practices, thank you companies, we also need digital citizenship. We need to create a citizenry, and I use the word citizen with a small c. I don't care if you're Canadian, American, Azerbaijan, I don't care where you're from. We need to create a population that is truly savvy and understands how to protect their own privacy, their own security, and their own safety. And finally, I want to suggest a way to accomplish that. Stop exaggerating the risk, and stop exaggerating how stupid you think we are. Because the reality is that most people get it kind of right most of the time. None of us get it right 100% of the time, and a lot of us get it wrong all of the time. But the fact is that even among teenagers, studies have shown that people do appreciate and care about privacy. So I want to see the privacy, safety, and security community do what the health community, the public health community, has done by using a social norming approach. It worked for anti-smoking, it worked for using seatbelts. It's working for excessive drinking. It's even helping some Americans stop eating too much, although we still eat too much. Try to understand that most people actually do want to get it right, try to get it right, and often do get it right, and stop exaggerating all the terrible things that are happening around us, and start focusing on some of the good things that are happening around us. Celebrate the positive, work to combat the negative, but whatever we do, let's try to create an enlightened and educated citizenry so that we can do what we can do to protect ourselves. Thank you.
Well, I'm very sorry to have cut off Larry, because I personally could have sat and listened to him all day. If you want to hear more from Larry, he will be participating in another panel. which you're going to have to get yourself to pretty quickly, in Salon AB.